All right. Welcome, everybody. I'm Rob Atkinson. I'm president of ITIF. And the reason we're doing this event is because, twofold reason. One is we did a report in October of last year called Digital Quality of Life, where we looked at how IT is transforming a whole set of areas of our lives, everything from education to healthcare to environmental protection to energy savings, and of course to transportation. And we looked at how IT is improving and can improve transportation, particularly surface transportation, trains, buses, cars, trucks. And to get that expertise on that, we turned to my colleague Jonathan Gifford, who I've known for years, and I'll introduce Jonathan in a second, but he was the lead author of that chapter, which there should be copies out there today. So today we want to talk about ITS, and in particular with the reauthorization of the Surface Transportation Act coming up maybe this year, maybe next year, talk a little bit about how ITS needs to play a key role in that. I had the pleasure to chair a National Commission on Surface Transportation Infrastructure Finance that was created by the last reauthorization, and we released our report in March, I guess, of this year. And we looked a fair amount at technology, and particularly how technology can address some of the issues around financing. So talk about that as well. So I'm going to start just with a couple of overview remarks, and then I'll introduce our speakers. When you think about our surface transportation system, it really faces several key challenges. One is how to build a sustainable financial model. Our commission found that we're underfunding our system at the state, local, and federal level by about two-thirds. So we invest about $76 billion a year in surface transportation. If you want to start making, keep the system from deteriorating and make modest improvements in conditions and performance, you have to be investing $210 billion a year. That's, by the way, just to put that in perspective, we would have to pass three stimulus packages a year just to make modest improvements. That's how far down we are. And ITS can play a key role there with things like congestion pricing and what we proposed, VMT, vehicle miles traveled fee. But secondly, ITS reduces the need for building new infrastructure. One of the key components of ITS is better management of our networks. We really, at the end of the day, have essentially, if you will, stupid networks. They're just pieces of concrete and steel, and it's up to the driver or the passenger to figure out what to do on them. There's very little intelligence built into them. And putting intelligence in the network, a number of studies have shown, gets you a much more efficiency of use of that network, and means you can invest less, and also gives passengers and travelers significant time savings and convenience. And lastly, because you can improve flow, you end up with environmental benefits of reduced fuel consumption. The question then is, well, where are we? We're doing a study now for the Sloan Foundation where we're looking at ITS leadership around the world to see what countries are in the lead in ITS. My colleague Stephen Azell here is the lead author of that, and we'll be releasing that perhaps as early as July, as late as September. And one of the key things we found is that the U.S. is not in the lead. I think Japan and Korea are in the lead around the world, maybe Singapore. And one of the things that they've done that we haven't done, essentially, is they've driven their ITS efforts really from the national level. The U.S. has driven our efforts largely from the state level, with some support, particularly in R&D, from the federal level. What Japan and Korea have done is driven it from the national level with national vision and leadership and a significant amount of investment. And they're way, way ahead of us. So if you go to Japan, you can have real-time traffic information in your vehicle. I remember last Christmas driving home from Home Depot. I went up to Home Depot up in Rockville, and I'm driving, and I'm coming home at Christmas, and I'm going to the 295 split, if you know where that is, you know. And I can go either way. I can go home to Bethesda either way, on River, or I can go down on Wisconsin, six of one, half a dozen of the other. So there's one of those information signs that says, "Don't go towards Wisconsin, totally jammed up." So I'm like, okay, I go on the river. Totally jammed up, accident on river. It was like nightmare. I'm like, why do I even bother listening to these signs? Because they're totally worthless. And if you've experienced these signs, you know that the data in them is usually out of date before you can even get there. So we really have some real challenges and opportunities, I would argue, to move to this next level. We just released a report here for the, in the U.S. with the help with the transition team, and then we did another version of it in the U.K. called the U.K.'s Digital Road to Recovery, where we looked at investing £5 billion in the U.K. on ITS, and it turns out there's fairly significant job generation gains from investing in ITS networks. Those gains would be even larger here in the U.S. So I think it's an important area for Congress to focus on, and we're really honored and pleased that we have one of the top leaders of ITS in Congress here now to join us, Congressman Mike Rogers. I'll introduce Congressman and if he make some remarks, and then if he has a couple minutes for questions, that would be great. So Congressman Rogers is from Michigan's 8th District, where he and he serves on the Energy and Commerce Committee and the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. He was appointed to the Intel Committee based on his experience and interest in national security. I see on his bio he's not only a former Army officer and a company commander in the 1980s, but also an FBI special agent. So he has a sort of double focus there, if you will, and was a member of the Chicago Bureau's Organized Crime Unit in 88 to 94. He's also on the Commerce Committee, and as part of that, or related to that, Congressman Rogers is co-chair of the Congressional ITS Caucus, along with Congresswoman Ellen Tauscher, so he brings a special focus to this issue and certainly a lot of knowledge about it. Before he came to Congress, Congressman Rogers was in the Michigan Senate from 1995 to 2000, and he served as the Senate Majority Floor Leader in 99 and 2000. He also has a strong business background. He was founder of EBI Builders, which is a family-owned construction business in Michigan, and is a member of several chambers of commerce. So with that, Congressman Rogers, we're pleased you can join us, and looking forward to your remarks.
Thank you very much.
Well, normally I like to speak after the dinner hour because there's an open bar. At least find that's more productive. Yeah, go with me. Well, enjoy your lunches, please, while we go through this. I'm just going to be fairly quick and then open it up to any questions. But you have the distinguished panelists, and I know Scott is going to lead the way through all of the concrete things that we can get done this year. But I just think if you look at where we were when we even started the ITS caucus, there weren't very many people who really even knew what that meant, intelligent transportation systems, huh? And once we got started and we brought the industry together that helped us educate members of Congress, and I can't tell you how important that was, you know, through events where they displayed their technologies and you could touch it and feel it, and most members of Congress learn as quick that way as they do anyway, like most Americans. And it really started to take shape, and we saw some real progress in legislation over the last few years. Nowhere near where we need to be. But now, when you talk about ITS in the halls of Congress, there is a recognition of what it is and how valuable it can be. From the very simple things of the amber alerts when the signs go up, to the very complicated things on either emissions or safety or congestion avoidance. I mean, all of those things, now people realize and understand how important they are and how integral they can be. But here's the challenge. We've got to tell even a more compelling story at this time of competing needs in these budgets about what ITS can mean to the challenges that face our transportation systems around the United States. And I think it can be done. You've certainly assembled the talented people to do that. You're all going to be part of this solution, which is pretty exciting. And I'll just tell you, I want to tell you this quick story because I'm a Michigander and we talk a lot about cars where I come from. Matter of fact, is anybody driving a CTS Cadillac? What? See me after. Built in my district. Got a heck of a deal for you. That'd be great. I'd take one home today. All right. Hey, that counts. That counts. And you should have one, too. They're very sporty now. You should see the 2010 model. Fantastic. We also build a Chevy Corvette, huh, in my district. The Buick Enclave. None of this is striking a chord here. How about the Pontiac G6? Soon not to be Pontiac anymore. Great car. The Chevy Malibu, huh? 2009, 2010. Car of the year. Right, this is part of my job. I have to do this. So please get out and buy one. There's great deals at a dealer near you. This is a true story. And it was Cheryl Vogel was driving her Ford Escape. And it was an intersection in Rockville, Maryland. And she was broadsided by a van. horrible. We hope to God nobody has to go through it. But here's, in her own words, how she described what happened next. And I'm going to quote now. After shaking my head and realizing what had happened, I heard a voice say, "I sense you there. You are in an accident, and I am calling 911. The Microsoft Sync system that she had set up the day before with her cell phone had called 911, in her words, for me. I told the woman at 911 that I was in an accident. She asked if I was hurt and where I was. I thought this stuff was only in the commercials on TV and radio. It really does work. The police arrived within minutes of the accident. In the two cars, there were a total of four people. I was there in the escape. There was one adult and two kids in the minivan, and all of us walked away with no serious injuries." And the story is really more than about child seats or safety belts. But there's one component of this story that I hope struck you as it struck me, and where it said, gee, this is where the government needs to step it up a little bit. The dispatcher had to ask, "Where are you?" That shouldn't really be a reality in 2009 going into 2010. And this is where we can make the investment in the infrastructure so that they don't have to ask when that goes off. Two great companies, Microsoft, American company. Ford, still an American company, despite what you might read in the newspaper. Two great companies doing great things, integrating technology for the betterment of the consumer. The one piece that's missing is the government stepping up and allowing the infrastructure so that, again, you don't have to say, where are you? What intersection are you at? What town are you in? Now, we have that on the private system with OnStar and other things, but this shouldn't have to be. The infrastructure of our public safety systems should be that well integrated because it cuts down the amount of time it takes to respond. And I can tell you, as a former law enforcement guy, that is critical to saving lives. Seconds mean everything. Minutes are a month of time in any other profession. It means that much. And we can do it. We can do it with right advocacies. Certainly these folks in ITS America and Scott and all the work that they're doing to promote, to educate, and to push forward an agenda that finally gets all this technology integrated. And imagine what we get to do after that when we can start talking about congestion avoidance. What does that mean for emissions? What does that mean for fuel efficiency in cars we already drive? What does it mean for public safety? And it's pretty exciting stuff. And how long will it be before we don't have to have the flashing Amber Alert sign that you'll get it in your car? That you'll get it on your phone, that you'll get it in your text to look for this car or that person. Or, gee, collision ahead, you may want to take another route, save some gas, save some emissions, save some time, get home to your family safely. All of that is possible. We just have to have the willpower to do it and fight that trend. If we just lay another layer of concrete, our lives will be better. Got to do that, but we also have to add this. Smart highways are going to be, I think, to the betterment of all of us. And for you and your efforts and all the technology you're going to promote, I can't wait to get started. So for that, I'm going to open it up to any questions that you might have. See, I told you the bar is always better than speaking. This is the coveted right after lunch speaking period. Everybody loves that time. Yes, ma'am. Yes. You're welcome, and I get to represent those folks. The first chairman we brought in the private sector and some public sector folks to serve on our kind of advisory council to help put forth proposals that we could work on here in Congress, and a guy named Brent Baer, who is as big as this doorway right over here. He is a huge, that's why I figured he'd be a great advocate, because who's going to tell him no? But he was led the country in integrating ITS into his system, and they did it all on their own with cooperation from industry, and that's really what kicked it off, and we took it to the state level, taking it now to the federal level. It's great stuff, so I appreciate that very, very much, and I thank you for your work that you're doing. You know, Mike, they're not going to listen just to Mike Rogers. They have to listen to people who are in the industry who can sell their companies and their technology. Yes, ma'am.
Thanks, Congressman. I've been there with IBM. IBM has a growing practice in this area of intelligent transportation solutions. One of the things that we've noticed, of course, is in the past, ITS has always been treated as part of research and always considered something that's futuristic, not really here and now. One of the messages we've been trying to convey to your colleagues is that these solutions are actually implementable now, but we need large-scale dollars to pilot them in a way that you can actually extrapolate the results in a major metropolitan area. So with that, are there events or things that you're doing within your caucus at the member level to talk about the need for really orders of magnitude more money going forward, especially with this bill, to do large-scale pilots and implementations to show what the art of possible is here and learning from what's already done in other countries overseas?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And the short answer is yes. How successful we've been is yet to be determined. But again, that was all part of the education process, and Scott knows this better than I do, but we have always asked for pilot projects to demonstrate what this was capable of doing. And it's always a trick. Again, remember, you're competing against somebody who needs some potholes filled. And that is an immediate thing. And some members still believe that ITS means cameras on poles. And that's what it is. And it is so far beyond cameras on poles. Now, it might be some of that. I know Brett Baird has the most integrated camera system, and they don't use it for law enforcement, by the way, which alleviates a lot of people's concerns. They use it for traffic control and management. And it's pretty exciting what they've been able to do, and you know, they keep it. So we're trying to tell those stories and say, we just need some, we don't need it all. We're not going to get it all. We shouldn't ask for it all. But we do need some set-asides for some projects on ITS so we can clearly demonstrate that, gee, maybe you don't need as much concrete poured next year. And, you know, I'm for pouring concrete, don't get me wrong. But I do think that where we can avoid that cost for the betterment of the driver and those families who are going to get their dad or mom home that much sooner, I'm in. Sign me up. And so we've just got to sell that story. And I, you know what? I think we should sell it as it is a personal thing. You know, ITS, it sounds kind of, you know, technology and ITS and congestion. I get caught in the same kind of, you know, speak that a lot of people do when they get excited about this stuff. But it really has human impact. And I think we do need to do a better job, starting with me, talking about the human impact. It's real. I mean, it does save lives. It does save time. It saves cost. If we make that case, we'll get a little bit more money, I hope. And I think Scott's going to talk about that today. Is that right? Yep. I don't want to steal his thunder, because he's good. Welcome. Yes, sir?
Chris Cody from Mark IV. We provide all the technology and transponders for EasyMask, which if you drive around in this area, you obviously probably know. Curious as to what your take on VMT is as far as the near term to the long term. I know it was a big part of the commission that Rob shared. And there may have been a little bit of mixed messages over the last couple of weeks as far as what may be part of this bill, what may be part of a future bill, whether it's going to be rolled out as a couple more pilot projects, or whether it may be promoted more long-term across the U.S. Just want to get your take on that.
Yeah, if I gave you an educated guess, I would say it's going to be more pilot project focused. I'm not sure that's the right answer, but again, given the constraints on budgets, and at least conversations I have heard, it's going to be more pilot project centered. And maybe they can expand it, maybe another state is eligible, maybe another region is eligible, but they're not ready to make that wholesale commitment. They're just not. And I'm not saying that's the right answer, but I just think that's where we're going. Because, again, you know, we're fighting that very old school thing here. I've got bridges that are broken, and I've got roads that are almost impassable. So that's got to come first. And so it keeps squeezing it. And we don't want to lose the momentum that I think we've gained. And I hope you all understand it's you know, we're not where we want to be, where any of you want to be, but it is serious momentum. And so we want, if it's another pilot project, well, we better take that than versus going nowhere. Yes, sir?
David Pickle.
David, you are the smartest person in this room, I just want you to know, because your father drives a Cadillac. That's funny. So whatever you need, you come by and see me in there.
I wanted to ask, the broadband stimulus is being rolled out. Do you think there's a potential with the infrastructure that's potentially being built there for a potential coattail ITS development on that, since they're going to have to build stuff and put broadband everywhere?
You can. I'm a little bit skeptical that they'll get their act together for any coordinated effort. You know, I'm for broadband development, but sometimes, you know, they're forcing it to go in places where the market's not ready versus places we know we could have them under money better spent. So we have this tug of war constantly going on. I would love to see an integrated rollout of broadband, because you have a lot of these, you know, the companies, many of who are in this room, have made their own personal investments in broadband development and have a business plan to make it successful. I wish we would kind of integrate with their plan for making it profitable. You know, and I'll tell you why I say that. I think ITS can be a market leader and has clearly shown that it has value added in the process. Therefore, a market will follow it. I mean, I just believe that. Remember the dot-com bubble? I mean, that was it. It was all, and it was not really real. People would come in and say, I'm going to lose money for 8 years, but you should invest hundreds of millions of dollars. And they all went, yeah, threw money at it, and it burst. Because there was no market that could follow that model for any length of time. And everybody was a new dot-commer, right? If you were 22 and knew how to use a computer, you were a dot-commer. And we paid a pretty heavy price for that. Going into, you know, 99, 2000 time frame, the economy went down. I get a little worried that we're trying to do the same thing with broadband. We're going to artificially create a market that isn't there. If we follow the lead of the industry who has invested in broadband and how they're doing it, that's a market-driven event. And I think we can get a lot out of it. And if we integrate it with things like ITS, that's a market-driven event. You know, it's Mike Rogers. You try having that speech in a T&I committee, transportation and infrastructure. You know, they kind of scratch your head and think you're nuts. So that part is a long way off. I hope that we finally get to the point like we have to integrate ITS into our transportation systems, that we integrate lots of technology and its transmission in all of the conversations that we have. Imagine how much easier it would be on this ITS front if we had complete integration with broadband layout development and infrastructure. Be huge. It's a little bit frustrating for us, but it doesn't mean we can't keep trying. Yes, sir.
My name is Greg Brooks. I'm currently unaffiliated, but I spent the last 2 years doing new media for President Obama's campaign. Mm-hmm. And you know, especially considering your pragmatic focus on broadband rollout, I guess I would want to ask, you know, in the very useful thought experiment of if tomorrow, you know, the White House and the leaders of both parties come to the ITS caucus and say, "We finally woken up. Tell us what to do. You have a blank check." I mean, how does the ITS caucus recommend the absolute best case scenario as far as rolling out this amount?
First of all, I'm resigning and starting an ITS company. kidding. That is a great question. And I think what we'd have to do, and with coordination of Scott and all the companies who sat around that table and all the players who helped us get here, and there's a lot of them, some small, some larger, some public sector folks who came together and I believe helped kind of get ITS on the radar, and I'm not talking about out in the community, I'm talking about here in Congress, to get those folks back around the table and say, you know, how do we do this in a way that A, is not self-serving? And I think people can still make money in the United States without a self-serving agenda about my technology beats your technology because I have the government tells me so. I think we can do that. And if you can lay out that framework and give a degree of certainty. We don't have to do a lot. I don't think the government really has to do a lot and a lot of it. But it has to give out a degree of certainty that we're going to make the investment in ITS in these categories. We're going to make that investment. Now, private sector, you're going to have to help us fill in the holes. And if we do that, I think we can go forward. And let me give you an example of how we have to be careful not to do it. I'm a big proponent of health information technology. And Anna Eshoo from California and I wrote a bill that was very bipartisan. We got bipartisan commitment in the Senate, bipartisan commitment in the House. She's Democrat for California, I'm Republican for Michigan. We worked together on these issues. And what we did in this bill was fairly unique. And we joked about it at a briefing this morning. We still think it was the best bill in Congress. Is that it just kind of set out the template of how to be successful. And here's the technology that we need. Here's the end game that we want to accomplish. The government is going to set these standards. Now, anything on that page, you have to fill it. You just can't go off the page. Go get it. And we had lots of venture capitalists and people all around the country saying, that's the model we need. I will pony up. I will invest money in that project. And think if we did the same thing on ITS. where I don't, you know, it's kind of easy to pick a winner and loser right now in ITS. Is the maybe the bigger company, maybe the more high-profile case. We tend in Congress want to say, well, I know that works. We'll write the law around that. If we resist that temptation, and the White House and the Congress get together and say, here is the white page, here's the piece of paper, here's our investment, go get it. I think it would be off the charts, because no technology would be prohibited. If the next great innovator came in next week, they're in. They're absolutely in. And we know what our investment is, so we don't have this large outgoing cash flow, which we can't account for in future budgets here. I think everybody wins. But as you all know, it's very difficult to get there sometimes, because I'm a member from, you know, I'd have all the government driving CTS Cadillacs by in my way, right? Yeah, that's just the way it works in Congress. But if we can resist those temptations and do it in that way, I think we'd be far better. I don't think you have to have a 40-page document of very specific things to accomplish what we all want to accomplish. Matter of fact, I argue it's probably counterproductive. Oh, and my point on that health IT story was they took our bill and then changed the bottom of it and focused a little bit on certain areas of technology. And then, because of that, it had to go to rulemaking for 2 years, Mike? 2 years. So guess what happened to all the private capital that was ready to go into health IT? It came to a screeching halt. Who in their right mind would put money into something where they had no degree of certainty in the next 2 years? Why would I put $3 million to develop a system in a hospital that I'm not sure would be interoperable with any other system in the United States? I'm not going to do it. And so instead of us unleashing on health IT, which we all thought was just fantastic, it actually brought it to a screeching halt. So that's always my thing. We have to resist that temptation to fill in the blanks from our end. We need you all to fill in the blanks on your end. We need to get started, give a degree of certainty, let you all fill in the page. Does that make sense? Now, you're a PR guy, right? You're a PR guy? Did you say you did the PR?
No, I apologize. Web stuff.
Oh, same. What's the difference, right? You sold him on the web? Get busy on this, because you guys were pretty good. So get busy on this. You'll get this thing turned around in a hurry.
Chris Bodie from Warren Forehead. I should have mentioned last time, proud Chevy Suburban owner.
That's good. That counts too.
One of the things that Rob mentioned in his early remarks is how the U.S., and I would tend to agree, this has fallen behind ITS-wise.
Yeah.
Mainly because we don't necessarily have a strong national program, and maybe that's because of our unique federalist model. Do you see the ITS program needing a stronger federal leadership to get the program rolling, or are we going to have to continue to get the states involved but somehow prod them more to invest more in ITS?
I mean, obviously it would be easier. We spend a lot of money on federal transportation dollars. We just do. It's a lot of money. You know, 19 cents a gallon times 50 states, a lot of money. And other ways we collect it on aviation fuel and other things. So I don't know how we shouldn't play a role. And I'm not a big mandate. I don't want to go tell Michigan you have to do it this way and Ohio you have to do it this way. But I do think, you know, getting back to that template model, we should set the course and say we think that ITS is an important investment for our future, not because it's cool, but because it has results. And it does add value to the taxpayer's dollar. And if we do that in a way that doesn't, again, go in and dictate what technology wins and what loses and what state wins and what state loses, I think that is exactly the role we should play. And in these budgets, that's why these pilot projects are important, because you take those pilot projects and say, see, we told you so. This works, and it works phenomenally well. You know, let's export what works. You know, let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's export what works. This works. And that system I talked about with Brent Baer, they were the first ones to have the whole county, and it's one of our largest populated counties in Michigan, wired for these cameras, right? And that's controversial in itself, but they got through all of those issues, and now they're constantly changing. They're keeping up with technology, and that's the beauty of it. They could have just said, this is it. They didn't. And we can't write a law that says this is it, because they're changing all the time. We just need to help encourage what they're doing and put some financial incentives, including cash, on the table for especially state DOTs to participate, and they should participate. I hope that answers your question.
Yep.
Right, I think you're giving me the hook back there. Well, thank you very, very much for being here. Thanks for your advocacy. This is something we can win. I believe it. in these budgets. And we can continue to get to a far better place than we are on ITS and build on all the great work that has already happened. And don't let your frustration for these folks who have slogged it out in the days, you know, where ITS meant absolutely nothing around here to where now it means something and now we can build on it. They deserve a lot of credit for hanging in there and being around and doing all great kinds of great things. So thanks for all that, Scott, too. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Congressman Rogers, for your remarks and certainly for your leadership on that. We hope we will make continued strides on moving forward with this. I want to turn it over now to Jonathan Gifford, and then let me introduce both Jonathan and Scott, and then Jonathan will make his remarks with a PowerPoint, and then we'll hear from Scott as well. Jonathan, if you don't know Jonathan, he's a professor of public management and policy at George Mason in the School of Public Policy. He's the assistant dean for research there, and he also directs the master's program in transportation policy, operations, and logistics. He has a long interest in telematics, or another word for ITS, going back to the early 90s, which was, I think we talked when I was back at OTA in the 90s when we were doing an ITS project at OTA, which never got published. He's been on several committees, chaired committees of the NRC, National Research Council, looking at DOT telematics issues. He's also the author of a book, Flexible Urban Transportation and Infrastructure Planning and Management. He has a PhD from UC Berkeley in civil engineering, MS at Berkeley in civil engineering, and a BS in civil engineering from Carnegie Mellon. And I think his most important contribution to the field, though, is the chapter he wrote in the Digital Quality of Life Report on transportation. So, Jonathan.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I wonder, will this sit up here? Yeah. Well, that, okay, I think I'll just use the arrows. So, and you say we're breaking at not later than 2 o'clock.
Right.
So I'll jump through some things here and speed things up. So isn't there a way to make this go to F5? All right. Oh. I was just going to, all right. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Rob and ITIF for giving me the opportunity to contribute that chapter, which was a fun thing to write. The idea was, you know, pretty high altitude, you know, sort of at 10,000 foot view of information technology in transportation, and all right, that'll be fine. Let's see.
Single page continues.
Full screen mode. So,
view. Oh, there. I'm sorry.
Park. Excellent. Thanks very much. It was a fun thing to write. I guess did you say there are copies of the book? I'll be happy to do autographs. Anyone who wants an autograph afterwards. I was going to show. This is just a clip from a 1958 Disney thing. I think I'll forego that in the interest of time. But the point was, you know, this is a picture of a legible highway sign that they imagined that would be necessary because cars would be going so fast and the lane directions would be color-coded so you could figure out which lanes to go on. They talk about new dashboard designs and digital readouts and having your rearview mirror be a television. And of course, you know, some of this stuff has come to pass, but, you know, that's a half a century ago, sort of imagining a future that we have to some extent realized in different components of our transportation system. And what I want to talk about is, you know, looking at IT as it affects transportation-related information, transportation safety, transportation system monitoring and management, and then talk a little bit about the challenges that we face as an industry trying to bring these things further into reality. And I'm focusing primarily on the public sector role the role of government organizations in trying to make this happen. Trying to improve traffic-related information or transportation-related information were already there in many respects, as many of you already know. Navigation information is widely available on handheld devices for routing purposes, for car, for transit. Google now has pedestrian directions as well. They're getting into bus schedule information, I believe, in one of the great breakthroughs. They've struck a deal with our own Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority to make their bus information available. These things do need to be negotiated out. Metro has a strong interest with that. But to put these technologies on the street, the illustration here, and it's not a very good illustration, but this is from the Paris system. That's deployed, designed to be, to fit into almost every flavor of bus shelter that's in the huge Paris bus system. Shows the bus lines that serve the stop. The readout's not very visible. Line 88. What's the destination of the bus? 3 minutes until the next one. 16 minutes until the following one. Bus 42. So every stop that you walk up to in Paris, bus system tells you when, however many lines are serving that, what the real-time information is. So that that kind of real-time information is here now in public transit systems in Europe, and I think in some cities here in the U.S. NextBus is a consortium, a seven-city consortium. It was implemented here on a test basis a few years ago or a year ago, taken down, I think, for some further refinement and development. So access to real-time information, not only traffic, but weather, road conditions, on-time arrival sorts of issues. Ride sharing, car sharing, being able to use in a collaborative sense. We have any slugs here? Anybody slug on 95? We have our slugging system, which is a very low-tech system of driving by parking lots down 395 to find a ride. There's hope that some sort of real-time ride matching might become possible. There have been concepts presented for real-time ride matching using IT to spread it out of beyond a single corridor, and also to allow cars to have access to HOV lanes on transportation systems. But car sharing is here now. Zipcar, widely deployed throughout this region. You reserve it online, pick up the car, and use it. Bike sharing systems in Lyon, in Paris, a small system that's been deployed here in Washington, courtesy of Clear Channel Communications and their bus shelter contract. We have 10 stations here in D.C. There's a system coming in Arlington. The Paris system, I think, has 5,000 stations around. I was in Paris on this trip on November of 2007, on the first day of the bus strike. That happened to be the day I was leaving Paris, and it was the transit strike. And the signs were up to date. It told you which lines were operating. The bikes were all in use, let me tell you. Every bike in Paris was checked out at that time. And that's IT is an essential component of that system. Prior attempts to develop those systems in Holland and Scandinavian countries failed because the bikes disappeared. There was no way to secure the asset of the bike. So the pricing and the security of the bikes is essential. In terms of safety, new initiative or newly named initiative from USDOT called IntelliDrive. Types of benefits that it can confer are the ones that the congressman mentioned just a moment ago: situational awareness, awareness of vehicles in adjacent lanes, automated cruise control that keeps you separated from vehicles in front, collision announcement, collision avoidance, and I think an important point is cost savings. Huge cost savings. GM in its current luxury cars that have 360-degree visibility has 8 separate sensor systems in order to achieve that 360-degree visibility around the vehicle. And that means you need 8 separate devices to be developed, to be integrated with the rest of the onboard devices on the vehicle, to be maintained, and to be warranted. So you have to, it's extremely costly and adds thousands of dollars to the cost of a vehicle just to try to get that 360-degree visibility. Under IntelliDrive, you'll be using advanced wireless communication so-called DSRC tags, dedicated short-range communication tags. The pictures from the DOT, the IntelliDrive website, you know, the idea that you have visibility of car-to-car, vehicle-to-vehicle communication, telling you when you're in a near collision, making you aware of the presence of other vehicles, vehicle-to-infrastructure communication that exchanges data with infrastructure. So, potentially a very valuable technology, but one that also poses enormous challenges. You know, we have tens of thousands of units of government in America that have some responsibility for operating the transportation, delivering and operating the transportation system, and getting that very widespread system completely equipped with devices, very, very challenging. I just want to finish my thought on the eight separate systems. A single device, according to GM, says they would save thousands of dollars per vehicle. And why is that important? It makes profits higher or vehicles less expensive, but it's also important because you can put it on a much broader range of vehicle price ranges. Right now, it's a luxury item. If you can get down to a single device solution, you may be able to equip every vehicle in the fleet with that type of technology and achieve the types of safety and other benefits that come to bear there. Road weather systems, a big challenge. All kinds of weather conditions that affect the transportation system and its usability for all classes of users and for the operators as well. The goal here is anytime, anywhere, weather information, what's the state of the transportation system to road users, to operating agencies. And weather is particularly complicated because of the role of private weather information providers. So the business model's there. It's taken quite a while to figure out what the appropriate boundaries are between government collectors of data that then becomes publicly available, to what extent do value-added providers then have resell that data in a value-added form. Do you have competition between the private sector and the public sector, and how do you work that out? It's very challenging. The notion of my favorite, I think, is what we could do. It seems such a low-tech problem to time traffic signals, but it's a huge, huge challenge to get reasonable data. There's some 270,000 traffic signals in America. Most of them are using outdated data. To design a good traffic signal system, you want data on the types of vehicles, the vehicle flows from every approach to the intersection. It's very expensive to collect that data and do a traffic study in order to design the signal splits, the red, green, and yellow times in every direction correctly. And most systems are either using data looked up in a handbook that has nothing to do with the actual place it's collected, or are using data that was collected 20 years ago, 10 years ago. So trying to keep that updated is a very expensive operation. A better ITS system could allow automatic updating of such systems in a much more efficient way. And estimates are hard to make what it would actually save, but something in the order 5 to 10% of congestion. Electronic payment, Chris Bode, nice to see you again, Chris. Working with EasyPass, one of the most successful ITS deployments, I think. How many tags?
18 million.
Pardon?
18 million
tags out there going all the way, I think, through Ohio. I don't think they've reached Illinois yet, but
Maine to Virginia and out to Illinois.
Okay, so a huge footprint, and I think why is that important? It reduces the cost of collecting tolls, of course, but it also expands the ability to look at tolling, and we are in a very financially challenged transportation environment right now. The ability to toll is one of the important ways, and certainly Rob's commission was looking at ways to try to raise revenue for meeting that shortfall in transportation investment through tolling, and also system operation. Variable tolling is an extremely effective way, at least our limited experience in the U.S., out in California, in Minnesota, of controlling congestion and giving giving opportunities to have a congestion-free trip for a price, in parallel with free general-purpose lanes. We'll have that here in the D.C. area in the next 5 years, probably, with hot lanes from south of Fredericksburg up to the Pentagon, and hot lanes going from Springfield around to the American Legion Bridge. Another important concept. The challenges, two slides and I'll wrap up. Technical challenges, Rob mentioned my interest in standards. It's extremely, we had a very strong role for the federal government those many years ago in 1945 when the government rolled out the interstate highway standards, 12-foot lanes, design speeds, all the stuff I learned as an undergraduate in civil engineering. What are the geometric design standards for the interstate system? And I remember Secretary Pena many years ago of transportation saying this should be the role of the U.S. government. We will set the standards to make intelligent transportation systems happen. Well, it's just a lot more complicated than that. IT is a lot more complicated than lane widths and design speeds. We're in a global vehicle market, and so looking at U.S. as a standalone market isn't very effective. And it's also the technology changes very rapidly. Should you come to consensus standards, a process that can take years, when your technology turnover rate is 6 to 12 to 18 months, it takes longer to develop the standards than it does to have the next generation of technology overtake it. So obsolescence is a huge problem. Legacy systems, a big problem. And procurement and joint procurement. I think one of the very interesting things about the EasyPass system was it was a joint procurement between six starter agencies that was done on a voluntary basis. It didn't have a mandate from the federal government. It didn't have you had six independent authorities, New Jersey Turnpike, Garden State Parkway, New York Thruway Authority, and some others who came together and came up with a common procurement for something, and that now we have 18 million copies of it operating on the roadways today. Institutional challenges, if the technical difficulties are significant, the institutional challenges can be huge. We have you think of them in three categories: jurisdictional. We have stovepiped agencies for highways, for transit, for rail, for airports. We have all kinds of functional stovepipes for design, construction, maintenance, operation, police, fire, and emergency. And we have a federal system, as was referred to before. So federal, state, county, city, public authority. Our local metro is an interstate compact, one of those things provided for in our constitution, two centuries ago. A bewildering variety, as one guy called it, of institutional arrangements. And trying to get all those levels and agencies to collaborate is hugely challenging. Sharing information, establishing and maintaining common plans, funding priorities, schedules. The funding problem has been alluded to already. Technical expertise. And finally, behavioral. Privacy was mentioned. It's a huge concern for some people who are observing the transportation system, although in the age of Twitter and Facebook, one wonders if the concept of privacy hasn't become a little bit obsolete. But it's a big concern, and if people have an alarm where somebody's privacy is violated, it could stop things cold or be a huge setback for us. And the adaptive behavior of drivers is the final point I'd make. One observer said the best way to improve highway safety is to put an unsheathed dagger in the center of the steering wheel, pointing at the chest of the driver. Huge change in behavior. When we put better brakes and smarter cars on the roadways, people's behavior changes. Anybody in Washington on a snowy day knows that people's behavior gets a little bit erratic when they think their vehicle is capable enough to climb any mountain or ford any snowbank. So how do we deal with that as we roll this technology out? That's another challenge. So with that, I'll stop. I appreciate your attention. I think we'll hold questions till the end,
yeah.
Right? And I think Scott doesn't have one, so maybe can we just shut this?
Can shut that off.
Okay.
Great. All right. Thank you, Jonathan. My favorite experience with red light was, I remember about 8 years ago, coming back from the July 4th fireworks. We were down near the mall and coming up Mass Avenue, and there were 4 million people going out Mass Avenue at 11:30 at night, and nobody coming in and nobody doing cross streets. And I was sitting at the light for about, you know, what seemed like 5 minutes, but it was probably about a minute, and no one coming this way, just sitting there, and 200 cars behind me waiting at the light. And I'm thinking, why don't we have intelligent lights? And we have stupid lights. They don't know that there are 100 people waiting at this light. Turn it green now. And those are the systems that we could easily develop if we had the national will to do so. I want to turn over next to Scott Belcher, who is the president and CEO of ITS America. ITS America is essentially a trade association that works to promote this concept and to advance it. Prior to joining ITS America, Scott was Executive Vice President and General Counsel at the National Academy of Public Administration. Before that, he's held several senior management positions at different trade associations and worked at private practice at the law firm of Beveridge and Diamond, and also at the EPA. He has a law degree from University of Virginia, a Master's in Public Policy from Georgetown, and a bachelor from the University of Rutland. So, Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, and thanks, Rob, for keeping the temperature down so everybody stays awake.
Focused.
Kind of interesting that. But first of all, thanks for inviting me to be here. I think, and if you haven't read the Digital Quality of Life report, you should, and in particular the transportation section. It's probably the best overview of ITS that I've seen. It's very, very well done and very, very presented in a wonderful way. So congratulations on a very good job. I told Dr. Gifford that I was going to share it with all of my staff so that they could make sure they knew what we were doing. And just on the traffic light thing, there are systems in the United States that that are using lasers and probes and artificial intelligence to make traffic lights smarter. Unfortunately, there are just as many of those traffic light systems that are set up that are no longer in use because the cities and states don't have the funding for them. I mean, that's the real sad thing. ITS America is a trade association, a society. Half of our members are public and half are private. Among the public members are other trade associations like APTA and ASHTO, our partners. Universities, George Mason is a member, as well as the state DOTs and transit organizations, city DOTs around the country. On the private side, you've heard from actually many of our members that are here, IBM, Mark IV, Quixote, but we've also got the automobile guys, the tolling folks, and traffic light guys. So we have the kind of the whole spectrum of people who are doing technology. So I'm not going to go over the technology piece. The only comment I would have is that much of the technology that we've talked about really is here. It's not. I mean, there are some technological leaps that we need to make as we go forward, but much of the technology is here. It's just here anecdotally. It's here a little bit here and a little bit there, but it's not here in a systematic way. And without having systemic systems, we're never going to optimize. Never going to take advantage of the technology in the way that we have. So as I look at technology going forward, I really see four things that are really the future of ITS or the future of technology and transportation. The first is a move to real-time multimodal traveler information. Some of that's here. I mean, again, you've got this, you can go into Google, you can see what your options are in Google. You can do the same thing on Microsoft, you can do the same thing with a number of systems. What's not quite here yet, or what hasn't quite come, is real-time information where you're being updated on what's really happening so you can make intelligent decisions about mode shift, about pricing, about distances, about the most environmentally friendly way to get from point A to point B. But that's coming. And part of the reason I can tell you that it's coming is you do have companies like Microsoft, like Google, like Clear Channel, like Nokia, who are all investing tens and not hundreds of millions of dollars of their own money to figure out how to capture your business. That's how you know that ITS is here, is when companies like that are spending that kind of money. So that's all coming. Okay, I think the other thing that's coming, the other thing that's the game changer in ITS and the game changer that has to come about as a result of the next authorization bill is a movement towards broad scale system integration. Right now you have a series of isolated systems. You have a traffic light system, you have a transit system, you have you might have a tolling system, but they don't talk to each other. The systems in Arlington don't talk to the system in Alexandria, and doesn't talk to the system in Springfield. And the system in Virginia doesn't talk to the system in DC, and doesn't talk to the system in Maryland. We need to make that leap from all these isolated systems to a broader interoperable system where that information is shared, that information is used, and we move forward. And I think some of the proposals that I'm going to mention that we're talking about in the next authorization can help us get there. Next generation safety applications. I think that's the other thing you're going to see as you go forward. Dr. Gifford mentioned a couple of them. I mean, and many of them are here already in the higher end cars. I actually drove a Nissan when I was in New York recently, and it had 360 degree awareness, and it pulled me back when I was getting too close to another car. Unfortunately, it had a beeper when you started to stray, and the people who I was driving with kept telling me to stop straying. I said, I'm not. This is the way I drive. So there are going to be some problems that we'll have to work through. But it's pretty amazing. That is a behavior. The other thing that's really cool is I actually drove in a car with really sophisticated adaptive cruise control. For 20 minutes, I didn't touch the brake or the gas along the Henry Hudson Parkway. So I was at 60 miles an hour, and I was at a dead stop, and everything in between without touching the brake. So really fascinating stuff. I think you're going to see that. And Dr. Gifford talked about IntelliDrive, the vehicle-to-vehicle, vehicle-to-infrastructure. That really is going to be the future of really reducing those 43,000 deaths a year, and we're going to see that. And then finally, I think the thing that we're going to see in ITS future is really options for financing, technological options for financing. Taking the stuff that Mark or the stuff that CAPSH does and continue to push the edge of the envelope. We're moving towards variable tolling, so that you'll be charged by at the time of day, by your weight, those kinds of things. But we also need to look at the technology to make vehicle-based user fees, or VMT, viable, because I think that's really going to be the future. We're not going to be able, we're not going to be able to pay for our system only with the gas tax. You know, now I'm actually hearing talk about taxing barrels of oil to fund transportation as the alternative to VMT and the alternative to gas tax. So there are a lot of things out there. The barriers to this really happening are a couple. I mean, clearly, I think one of the biggest barrier is obviously, Dr. Gifford talked about them, biggest barrier really is funding. But it's more than that. It's political will. It's political will. I think you're going to see another barrier is performance requirements. If you can get away building roads or building bridges and not building smart roads, not building smart bridges, not being held accountable, you're going to continue to do what you've always done. And much of the country, I mean, these folks are our members, they're my friends, but when you're faced with that question of, you know, are you going to fill the 2-foot pothole or are you going to synchronize your traffic lights, it's a hard question. And you saw this in the stimulus package. I mean, there was all kinds of talk about all the jobs that were going to be created through infrastructure. 7% of the money went to transportation. You wouldn't believe that if you listened to the rhetoric. And of that 7%, very little of it went to intelligent transportation. I think the only, at least on the highway side, I think the one thing that you did see that I thought was intelligent in the transportation side is the $8 billion that went to high-speed rail and some of the other rail stuff that's there. But you know, we've got a long way to go, and we need that commitment. So ITS America And our coalition of a number of people, including many of the people in this room and at this table, are forwarding a letter, a call to Congress to make an investment in ITS and to really take this seriously. I think you'll see the letter in the packages outside. It's right here. The package outside has both the letter as well as our authorization principles, what our coalition is asking of Congress. And we partner with a number of different groups. I mean, that's the way Washington works. I mean, Art and I from APTA, I mean, we partner on the stuff that he's doing. He partners on the stuff that we're doing. Some stuff we agree not to talk about. But the things that we're looking for, first of all, we believe that the next authorization bill needs to build in real incentives for performance. States, local governments, MPOs need to be held accountable. And they need to be incentivized to invest in infrastructure, incentivized to invest in transportation. If you have targets, reduced congestion, reduced deaths, you're going to have to do things in different ways. You're going to have to take advantage of technology. And there needs to be a national scorecard. Part of being held accountable is being able to use the power of publicity. We think that'll take us a long way. I think we need to put smart technologies to work. So we've agreed with the ASHTO proposal to seek $3 billion a year for operations and maintenance of traffic information systems. And of that $3 billion a year, we're looking for $1 billion for ITS deployment and maintenance. That's a game changer. And I think the thing that, for me, the most exciting thing about our proposal is a new initiative that we have called the Smart Towns and City Streets Initiative. And this goes to actually what Congressman Rogers was talking about, as well as Professor Gifford. And that is that we need to take all of the good data, all of the good technology that's out there, and we need to take it to the next level. And part of that is taking it from small cities, but really building large test beds. And so what we're talking about is a $200 million a year program that the federal government partners with private sector, state and local governments to invest in one or two cities a year, where we build out a transportation infrastructure that's based around technology. So when you talk about GM having technology that allows for driverless cars, or you talk about bus platooning, where the first bus has a driver and then the next buses are 2 feet apart, through technology, you can actually demonstrate those in a place where people use them in a safe way, and we can build that public momentum that's necessary to create those large nationwide systems that I'm talking about. So we're excited about that. We're also, the final thing that we're looking for in this authorization is to double the research budget, because again, I think as we move from smaller scale programs to larger scale programs, we're going to need some additional investment in research. And so with that, I'll stop and turn it back over to Rob.
All right, well, thanks, Scott. We've got about 15 minutes left, so give a good amount of time for questions or discussion. If you have any, raise your hand and identify yourself.
I'll ask Art. One here.
Are you going to identify yourself?
I'm Art Gazzetti. I'm with the American Public Transportation Association, and I'd like to ask the, with the emphasis of the transportation bill on do you think it's understood by people who are talking about performance measurement that implicit in that is you need data collection and data systems to get back that? Is there a connection that one has to come with the other, or is it possible there's a disconnect between those two facts? Or is my question off base? So A, B, C.
Well, I think it's a good question. I think in the way that we've drafted our proposal, and I think the way that you and I would talk about it, clearly they're linked. Clearly you can't have performance without data. But I do, you know, and that would, and that will drive why there will be strong resistance to performance-based systems among some of the some government entities.
Thank you.
because they're, you know, it's tough. A lot. I mean, the states and local governments are so underfunded right now. Transit organizations are so underfunded right now that being held accountable to a new set of standards, it is anathema to many of them, simply because the thought of is, so where do I get the money to do this? And so I think it will be. I think there is a disconnect, I think, among some folks, but I think we're going to continue to try to educate Congress to make sure that they see that connection.
I think we've seen on the capital project side and state DOTs, we've seen a move towards some transparency and accountability. I know the dashboard system in Virginia, you know, which was done by the, I guess, the previous commissioner. You know, every project in the Virginia plant, they used to build, have construction projects in Virginia. They seem to have done away with that now. But they had their entire construction program was available through a dashboard on the web. You could drill down by location. You could drill down by system. All about, you know, is it on time? Where is it on its budget performance? We've seen some, and I think Homer Carlisle, who works with Art, and I wrote a paper about this several years ago. One of the things that was remarkable there was that the people inside the organizations had never had the data to see this either. You know, VDOT implemented the dashboard system, at the strong insistence of the commissioner, and suddenly the managers in VDOT were empowered to deliver. They knew, you know, what they actually had the information that would allow them to perform. And I think, you know, there is a vast deficit of data on performance, not only for the public but also for the people inside the organization, because of stovepipe organizations, antiquated systems, all kinds of reasons. And I think, pushing that, I think, is a very very good idea, but one that will meet some resistance.
I guess I'd just add to that, Art, you know, if you design the system the way Scott was talking about, with sort of a kind of an open data format with interoperability, so the data can be used in many, many different ways. Frankly, to me, it ought to be able to be used for the people who want to do mashups and match it to Google Maps or whatever they want to do. But anyway, I think that one of the key, to me, principles about ITS is that most of these systems are dual use, triple use, quadruple use. So you build a travel information system, you can use it for that. You can also use it for accountability and performance. So it's not like we would build a separate accountability system that these things could, if you put all the data together, could be used that way. Yes, sir.
My name is Dave Witzel with the Environmental Defense Fund. Dr. Gifford, thanks a lot for the talk. Very helpful. A question I guess with two sides of the same question. What should we be looking for in terms of intelligent transport to make sure that we're improving the environmental impact of transport? And I guess generally, it looks to me like ITS, you know, superficially at least, will have a negative environmental impact because it will tend to increase car driving. Is that true? And other things we do?
Well, this is the age-old question. I think 1990 or something, I helped organize a conference on, you know, transportation. Deborah Gordon was one of the speakers. You know, is there good VMT and bad VMT? You know, ambulance VMT is good. You know, cruising down Main Street on a Saturday night is bad VMT. And I don't think in America we're going to get into a debate where the government decides the good VMT from the bad VMT. Having said that, I think we're seeing improvements in vehicle technology that reduce the tailpipe emissions of cars. I think, you know, we've seen huge strides in that in the last several decades. I don't think, if you look at IT, broadly speaking, I think enabling, you know, the Paris bike system or the Lyon bike system or an expanded system here in this area or Zipcar, I mean, IT is an essential part of that. And I don't think it has to be more VMT or less VMT. I think, you know, it's going to be what people want. Reducing congestion is, you know, likely to reduce tailpipe emissions. There may be some induced demand that is caused as well, but we may be able to handle the demand if we have a better managed and operated systems. 30%, you know, 30% of driving in some cities is looking for parking. Mm-hmm. If we have better systems that help you, you know, if we could, you know, avoid hunting for parking. I parked at the Baltimore, you know, parking deck the other day. Many of you probably have done the same. It's a remarkably simple, obvious, you know, you don't have to have an instruction guide. You know, you drive in, it's obvious, and you drive directly to a parking place and park. Then I drove over all 17 levels of the national airport system the other day in increasing frenzy looking for a place to park because I was worried about missing my plane. So, you know, those sorts of things can, I think it can go either way.
I have two comments to that. I mean, first of all, Environmental Defense Fund is working with ITS America and a number of other organizations to produce a study called the Moving Cooler Study. Are you familiar with that? We're looking at, combination of 40 different technology solutions as well as transportation policy solutions and looking at their impacts on climate change. And that study should be released at the end of June. So we've been working with Michael Rapogel from your organization. The results are, in addition to what Dr. Gifford has suggested, ITS is not all about cars, and in fact, I mean, you know, what you're seeing is that in the biggest cities, which is where 80% of the population resides, there's not enough space to build any new roads, and so technology is the only way you can make those roads work. Through pricing, it opens up all kinds of new policy choices. I mean, if you price your roads appropriately, there is revenue to make mode shift decisions and to provide other opportunities. And I think the one thing that especially in the United States, we always have to be aware is that the solution set for each of our jurisdictions is different. And so some places, what you're going to see is you're going to see cities figuring out how to open up roads and open up for more traffic. In other cities, you're going to see very clear mode shift as a movement to light rail, movement even to heavy rail. And you're going to see a big part of that in this next bill.
Just one last piece on this. When you move to congestion pricing, the environmental benefits are pretty clear. A number of studies have shown that because people are underpaid at congestion, and what they do is they do some kind of mode shifting. A certain portion will shift over to transit or shift to work at home for a day. Certainly some off-peak shifting as well, but there does seem to be pretty clear evidence that congestion pricing is.
Can I make a comment on that?
Sure.
This, I'm Stephen Ezell with ITIF. I'm writing the study that Rob mentioned earlier about benchmarking countries' leadership in ITS. Japan has done an awful lot of work in this space of looking at the connection between congestion and environmental impact. A couple of things they found. 30% of congestion on Japanese roads was found to be at toll collection stops. Now that Japan has gone to 68% of their toll rolls have electronic road pricing, easy pay, multiple tags, that has decreased their congestion substantially. They found that vehicles traveling at 60 kilometers per hour emit 40% less congestion than vehicles traveling at 20 kilometers per hour or below. Vehicles traveling at 40 kph emit 20% less. So they found that by having the vehicles on their highways move at railroad traffic speeds has substantially decreased congestion, and they're on pace to decrease their congestion, the pollution levels coming from transportation by 2010 to their 1995 levels.
Yes, sir, and then here.
With regard to the...
Yeah, identify yourself.
Larry Bruiser with Mitsui USA. With regard to the point that you made in the beginning about Japan and Korea being far ahead of the U.S., point that your associate just made, has there been any discussion in the field about trying to attract some of those foreign technologies here, or conversely, to keep them out in order to promote the American counterparts?
Well, it's not really a technology issue. At least that's my observation. We work with each of the ITS organizations in the different parts of the country. We do have some situations where it's very difficult for international companies to break into the United States with good technology. I mean, CAPTCHA is a company that's based in Austria that has tolling throughout much of Europe, and they're trying to figure out a way to break into our market. Among U.S. manufacturers, I know we have a difficulty breaking in to European and Japanese markets, partly because standards are different. And we're operating on different systems, different bandwidths.
But it's the technology is there. I think it's really it's the question of political will, and I think Rob mentioned it before. The amount of money and emphasis that these governments place on this is really remarkable. For example, Korea is hosting the ITS World Congress in 2 years. And we just hosted it this last year in New York. Our private companies probably invested in terms of real dollars and actual time spent on the order, you know, tens of millions of dollars voluntarily. The Korean government is investing $20 million to make sure that they have a World Congress that is special. That's a difference. Similarly, when I take my companies over to South America to try to compete for that market, one of the things you find there is that the European government don't have any hesitation about promoting their businesses the way that we do. I mean, actively promoting them. And so that's one of the things we've seen in trying to overcome that.
I will say, you know, that in the international standards program, or in the ITS standards program within USDOT, you know, there's been an ongoing discussion about what role a DOT should play. Are they promoting technology? Isn't that the job of the Department of Commerce? It's not DOT's role to promote American companies necessarily. I don't think that's the official policy now, but this is a debate. You know, are we coordinating or not? Are we leading or not? We have a privately based standards system in America that is very different than Japan and very different than Europe. And so that can pose a challenge as well.
Hi, Megan Hausert from the House Committee on Science and Technology. You mentioned that one of the suggestions is recommendations is to double R&D budget. Just one of the examples that you all talked about was the Google system of travel information data. And my understanding of that is that it sort of arose out of an initiative of Google where they, you know, made a very simple application that people could feed data into. What research needs are you talking about when things do arise organically?
Well, I don't think that USDOT should be in the position of doing research in areas that the private sector is ultimately going to do. There are a number of areas, for example, as it relates to active safety controls, where the market doesn't currently, the market's not going to drive those solutions, that USDOT can help in. I think the other place that USDOT, personally, I think the place USDOT can help is to spur research and moving to these large systems that I talk about, helping work with companies like IBM and Cisco and others to try to take what's happening at the very local and micro level and figure out how to make it, how to open it up so that it's on open platforms. Things like and another area is things like software-enabled radios, some stuff that the private market just doesn't have the interest in at this point. I mean, that's where I see it happening. But I don't see it supplanting private sector investment, because I think where I really see it is in the places that the private sector isn't incentivized to make those investments.
I would add, trying to look at the performance, how do you develop performance standards? How do you develop data systems to support performance standards? If we are really going to have a performance-driven system, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in figuring out how do you measure it. Now, New Zealand has done tremendous work in incorporating a performance measurement into their system, but it's a challenge implementing it in an American model where we have, as I mentioned, tens of thousands of independent units of government that are not going to shred their constitutions and say, "Oh yeah, I give it up to the state, and my citizens can stop voting, and we'll just turn this activity over to the state." It's just not going to happen, and I think that's a huge challenge, a technical challenge, and an institutional challenge.
I just add on the Google thing. It's a cool application, but I think it's important to recognize that underlying the Google application is inherently only worth the data that is put into it. And if you ever look at the Google application, you realize there's very little data. Most of the roads don't have any information. Oftentimes, the information is out of date. So that, to me, is a big public role, is to create this data set that then Google or Microsoft or IBM or anybody else could then use. That's not a research question, that's really what, in many ways, I think the genius of the Japanese and Korean models is that they essentially created this real-time data system and then that used by all these other companies who then go and build applications around it. We went down a different path, which I think was not a very good path, which is proprietary data by one company that isn't very good, isn't broad enough.
I'm wondering...
Could you identify yourself, please?
New Orleans, I have no affiliations. I'm wondering if it's been abandoned or either been the concept of intelligent drivers. If you're on the road with your family somewhere and you're reliant only on intelligent systems and intelligent vehicles, and you're therefore concluding that you need not be concerned about that party in the other vehicle, aren't you likely to face a problem at some point? I guess my question is this: no matter how intelligent the vehicles and the systems are to be, there still has to be some attention devoted to smart people at the wheel, even if they don't control all aspects of what's under them and connected to the wheel.
Well, I take your point. I think we were talking beforehand. You know, America is very reluctant to engage in strong behavior modification. The knife, unsheathed knife, you know, we don't do that. We don't, drunk driving. If you go to Europe and look, you know, they have intelligent speed, what is it called, ISA, intelligent speed adaptation, you know, where the roadside says slow down and it will force your vehicle to slow down. We can't get red light cameras, outside of certain jurisdictions in Maryland. I mean, it's, you know, we are very reluctant to have strong behavior modification. But I'll also say, you know, we have an aging population, people who have diminished capacity to see, whose reaction times are slower. We need all the help we can get. And there is an adaptive, you know, sort of a behavioral adaptive response in some cases, but I think still net, we have 43,000 people dying a year, and it's important to try to do everything we can within our system to reduce that.
The proponents of intelligent vehicles and intelligent roads and intelligent transport systems foresee a decline, a lowering of the number of fatalities at some point as a result of intelligent vehicles and technology?
Yes. I mean, part of the problem is that we've gone to partially intelligent automobiles and we've gotten a little bit lazy, and so I think we do have to go further. But the whole goal of what's called the vehicle to infrastructure, the smart cars, is to prevent cars from crashing.
And it's going to circuit.
You know what, I'm going to intervene here because we're a little bit over time, so if you'd like to have that conversation, let's do it offline, because I promised people we'd be out at 2, and I violated that promise. It's 4 after 2.
Rob, can I just mention, if you want to see this technology, the technologies that we've talked about, on June 1st through the 3rd at Gaylord's, the place over in Port Washington, Maryland, ITS America has an annual meeting. We've got an exhibition hall as well as demos outside, so you can go and feel and touch this technology.
Well, great. And I think they'll be around for a few minutes, so please join me in thanking John.